This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, our guests include General Russell Honoré, the man who led Louisiana's comeback from Katrina. His latest book is Leadership in the New Normal. We'll talk with General Honoré about tomorrow's 8th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina sweeping through our state and changing our landscape forever. Also, General Honoré on the March on Washington 50 years ago. It was August 28, 1963, that Dr. Martin Luther King delivered his 14-minute address, words that reverberate in our society today. And Carol Handler, an attorney who lives in Los Angeles, who was there 50 years ago at the age of 27, she saw and heard Martin Luther King change the course of history on this date a half century ago. All this, now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Your numbers are 297-5633 locally and outside the area, 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. It was 50 years ago today that the March on Washington took place in Washington, D.C., with Martin Luther King delivering a stirring address, 14 minutes long, considered by many to be the most prominent speech of the 20th century. And among the 250,000 or so witnesses to history was Carol Handler, an attorney in Los Angeles, who was a young person who started this day 50 years ago, planning to see Dr. King and others speak at this particular event. And we have found her by virtue of the fact that she was featured in the New York Times on Saturday. And Carol Handler, I understand your phone's been ringing from places all over the country since Saturday's story about you.
It really has amazed me. I heard from old friends that I had not spoken to in years, opposing counsel, but most of all, people who were touched by the day as I was, and who just reached out and wanted to share their thoughts and experiences. And you know, I was 250,000th of the crowd there, but I'm so glad that I was there. It meant so much to me, and it's wonderful to know that people are caring and sharing those, and still sharing those values.
Why did you participate?
It was something I wanted to do. I was very concerned about civil rights, discrimination. Obviously, I am not African-American. I go into private school. I have a different background, but my family is Jewish. My father was very conscious of the Holocaust, and I wanted to do something, but I didn't know what to do. I couldn't organize myself to go and do sit-ins, although I thought about it, but this came up. And I just did it. I got up early, much earlier than we are on the phone, and I ran down to 30th Street Station in Philadelphia and got on a train and went to Washington. Jim, what you have to recall was that there was a lot of fear of violence at the time, and some of the New York Times stories brought this out. People were concerned. President Kennedy at one point was trying to stop the march, but then it was very clear that he supported its goals, and he didn't. And people walked through the train telling us to make sure not to engage in any confrontational activity. So I didn't know. I really didn't know what to expect. The train pulled into Union Station, and the city was like a dream city. There was no traffic. There were just pedestrians and peace officers, and it was amazing. It was, the city had emptied out, and that was a very big part of this. You felt this spirit of, there is not going to be any violence. There is going to be a display of brotherhood and you know, and important values. It just it was It was hanging in the air. It was amazing.
Well, today's New York Times puts it this way. It was late in the day, hot, after a long march and an afternoon of speeches about federal legislation, unemployment, and racial and social justice, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. finally stepped to the lectern in front of the Lincoln Memorial. He began slowly with magisterial gravity, talking about what it was like to be black in America in 1963. And about halfway through his prepared speech, Mahalia Jackson shouted at him from the speaker stand, telling him to talk about the dream. And that he did. And the rest, as they say, is history. J.C. Kane, let's go, J.C., let's go to Dr. Martin Luther King on this day.
From the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire, let freedom ring. From the mighty mountains of New York, let freedom ring. From the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania, let freedom ring. From the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado, let freedom ring. From the curvaceous slopes of California, but not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring, and when this happens, and when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
Carol Handler, did you realize those words would carry so much weight all these years later?
Of course not. But again, the speeches, not to take anything away from the other people, there were great people on the platform, but Bayard Rustin, A. Philip Randolph, but the speeches were from as much from the head on issues as they were from the heart. This speech just, you know, it was raw emotion and soul and commitment just pouring out of this man, and you had to feel the passion, and ultimately that is what I think really brings about change, that kind of commitment and caring and the ability to touch another human being's soul. So I have to tell you I would like to see much more progress. This has not been a good year in terms of human relations, in terms of people working together for very legitimate political ends. I'm very disappointed in the voting rights decision. Things are certainly way beyond where they were in 1963 in terms of African American rights. But John Lewis, who spoke this morning, is so right. We're way away from where we should be. Great leaders were produced out of that experience, and the speech was obviously the climax of the day and the most important event that happened. But I'd like to try to communicate the feeling of the day. It was everybody was in communication. It was as if you had 250,000 brothers and sisters. That's about the only way I can describe it. We all looked at each other. We all read each other's eyes. Maybe I'm over romanticizing it, but people were not there just for themselves. They were there because the issue was important, and there was a huge amount of mutual respect and camaraderie and hot weather, sore feet notwithstanding. It was incredible.
You write that at one point you were hungry, you're making your way through the crowd, and you run into a black family with a grandmother, and what did she say?
She said, honey, are you hungry? I don't know how she knew it, but I sort of thought about it, and what's the polite thing to do? And I said, yes. And she invited me to join them, for they were having a picnic. They were eating roast chicken sandwiches with sliced cucumbers, a very British sandwich. And I sat down with them, and we talked. She was from Georgia, and she had some little kids there who were running around. That was the way the day was. You stopped and talked to people, and listened. The other thing I want to say was I was very sitting on the platform. There were significant African American leaders, obviously major fathers of the civil rights movement, but there were a lot of people. There were a number of Jewish rabbis, which I was very proud of, and other white people, and that was a day in which different groups actually could work together and didn't necessarily turn on each other. And it's something that Clarence Jones, who was interviewed this morning on NPR, has dedicated a lot of his life to, and that we really need to see more of in our society.
Mm-hmm. Well, as we let you go to your work in Los Angeles, and it's early in the day in California, in the South, we tend to think of race sometimes as a Southern phenomenon, a Southern issue, but you've had your share of challenges in California.
It's not a Southern issue at all. It's a New York issue, which is where I grew up. It's a Philadelphia issue, which is where I worked for many years. I worked in North Philadelphia doing community organization in relation to the school district. It's a fundamental issue in our society, and something which probably will never be completely overcome, but which we have to deal with much more honestly and openly than we do. And it's very, very important. Human beings are important. We all have our families. We want the best for our families. What goes on in the world around us, I don't mean to make a speech, I apologize, but what goes on in the world around us and is really important, and that's how I felt when I was a teenager and in my 20s, and it's why I went into urban planning and then ultimately went to law school.
Well, thank you, Carol Handler. I hope we talk again soon.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you for including me.
My pleasure.
Have a good one.
You too.
Have a good one.
Thank you. And we're joined in studio now by General Russell Honoré, who was a young man, I guess a high schooler, back on August 28th, 1963. You recall that time?
Yes, sir. I was a sophomore at Rosenwald High School in New Roads, Louisiana.
How was Rosenwald High School in those days?
Well, we still had segregated schools then, and it was a great environment. The teachers, public school, of course. Our principal was E.C. Nelson, great leader and preacher when he wasn't running that school as a principal. The leaders in that school were men of stature and very respected in the community, our public school teachers. And they themselves were the beginning of that movement, as little as it was in Poinkapie Parish. They were the brain trust of how to go about to make that dream happen in Poinkapie.
But no whites.
No, sir, not in that school.
When did you first encounter a white person in your collective experience?
I went to Southern University. Of course, back then, 4-H, everything was segregated. Went to Southern University, and we had a couple teachers. But the first real integrated experience was my sophomore year at Southern. I went to ROTC summer training at Fort Sill, Oklahoma, and that was my first experience in a tent for about 5 weeks.
So you must have been around 20 years old, right?
Probably 20, yes.
Yeah, before you really experienced a white person. And
well, I wouldn't say that. I had people in our community I used to work with, Grover Shoes, and our neighbors we knew, so I wasn't that isolated.
297-5633. We'll return with General Russell Honoré after this 90-second pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. 50 years ago, General Russell Honoré, who is with us, was 15 years old in Rosenwald High School when Dr. Martin Luther King delivered his stirring address. And a study of census information from 1960 to the present shows that in 1963, 56% of black Americans lived below the poverty line. Today, that number is 28%. It's been cut in half, although here in Baton Rouge, it's much higher than 28% for African Americans. But has there been real progress in the last half century?
Well, absolutely. I'm sitting here as a retired lieutenant general. We've had a lot of progress, but there's much work to be done. And that 28% across the nation, as you eloquently said, isn't distributed equally. We're in the poorest state in the nation, one of the largest concentration of poor of people in the nation right here in Louisiana. And many of them are south part of Plattsmouth Parish, right here in parts of Baton Rouge, and points north. So, yeah, we still have a problem with poverty in Louisiana.
297-5633, if you'd like to join the conversation with the remarkable Russell Honoré. 8 years ago, he led the comeback from Katrina, and that anniversary is tomorrow, August 29th, 2005, a day that will live in infamy in Louisiana. And General Honoré has written a new book called Leadership in the New Normal, a short course, and it talks about his experiences and some of his advice for the rest of us. Walter Isaacson, by the way, says, like Andrew Jackson, General Honoré rode in to save New Orleans at a time of dire need. In this book, he looks at the leadership lessons he learned from Hurricane Katrina and his years of service in the Army. He explains how we have to adopt new ways of communicating and commanding in a global era that he calls the new normal. 8 years ago, where were you when Hurricane Katrina swept through the state?
Well, Katrina was 8 years ago, was still stirring around in the Gulf, had left Florida and was making his way across the Gulf. And I was in my headquarters in Atlanta, this being the day before Katrina, and a Sunday. And we had just finished a conference call listening in to FEMA, Northern Command, and the president had just talked to them about the situation and how bad it could be. And at that time, we had submitted our request for forces for First Army in case we would need it. Requested ships and a lot of helicopters, and all those were working their way through the system.
And when you got there, was it worse than you imagined?
Yes, because even the news hadn't gotten there to really portray how much of the city had been flooded. I got to Mississippi on Tuesday. You know, Katrina had physically on Monday. Tuesday, I got to Mississippi, and Wednesday morning at 8:47 thereabouts, I arrived in New Orleans on a Navy helicopter.
What did you find?
Flew into the Superdome. There was about 16,000 people, we're told, by estimates. The National Guard was there working with the people, trying to take care of them. Louisiana National Guard was doing a great job there. We had a meeting with the mayor and the head of the National Guard and the head of FEMA. And the problem on the table was, how do we conduct the evacuation of the city? We had hundreds of helicopters en route to come in and facilitate the evacuation, as well as the great Louisiana Cajun Navy was on the ground saving people in their boats, everybody from Fish and Wildlife to volunteers to sheriff departments, who actually did most of the rescue work in New Orleans.
What was the scene like in the Superdome?
It was horrific. By Wednesday morning when I got there, the people were standing outside because the inside had become violated by the storm itself. You remember the roof was torn off, piece of it was hanging out, and the inside just became intolerable. So people were standing outside just waiting. And I can remember landing there in that helicopter and looking at people in the eyes, and many of them looking at this as a potential ride out. It was a eerie feeling to see that happening in the United States of America. I looked over the side of the Superdome, and I could still see that picture in my mind of a young lady with two babies in a shopping cart pushing it, and the water is up to these babies' chest standing in the shopping cart. That was a a horrific sight that I'll never forget. And it motivated us to get things done and help the evacuation.
Well, if you and your troops had not taken control, it could have been much more disastrous. Those were perilous moments, weren't they?
They were, and we worked in coordination. I use that word take control very generally with respect to the National Guard and the buses that came in from FEMA, the Coast Guard, and all of the great aviators, to include some from private industry that came in and got people to safety. What we were able to do is to help collaborate that movement from the Superdome to Houston.
Well, Ali Velshi of CNN says, I met General Honoré when most of America did, when he marched onto the scene and took control of a rapidly deteriorating post-Katrina New Orleans. He was the leader America needed, brave, disciplined, decisive, and ready to ignore convention to get the job done. This book, Leadership in the New Normal, shows how to emulate his brand of leadership in whatever we do. Now, you spent 37 years in the United States Army. How did that experience prepare you for the chaos that was Katrina?
Well, to look at this as a mission, not as a political string board to do something else later. I looked at this as a mission, focused on the mission. And the mission Governor Blanco gave was to help facilitate the evacuation of the city, keep people alive, provide food, water, and medicine to people. That's basically the priority of work she gave when I went to visit her around noon on Wednesday, the day I arrived. And that's what we worked on until we facilitated that evacuation, as well as to transition the federal troops coming in on that Saturday, as well as picking up the remains of people that were on the street, and as well as providing food and water to people who did not evacuate.
How was the experience working with the President of the United States during that time?
I've got to say it was an enormous honor to work directly with the President and to get his guidance direct, to answer his questions and to dialogue with him at some pretty tough times, and to work through his staff, who most of the communication happened, but I had spent a few hours with him on a couple occasions, and that was an honor to listen to him and understand his intent of what he wanted to have happen.
How much contact, General, did you have with Governor Blanco?
The entire time I was here, I saw Governor Blanco just about every day, or talked to him on the phone. And I think sometimes people make more of the difference between these two leaders than what I saw. Both of them had a common purpose. That was to take care of the people. Now, everybody have their own Katrina story based on what they saw. But the enemy in this was the storm. The storm overmatched our infrastructure. It overmatched our evacuation plan. And it hit the largest concentration of poor people in the state of Louisiana, which is in New Orleans Parish, Jefferson Parish, and in St. Bernard and Plaquemine Parish.
You write that during difficult times, the leader must be visible to his or her people.
Yes, sir.
Why? How so?
I think when we look at the purpose of government and why people appoint a leader, is for somebody to speak for them and to look out for them. And that leader, when a problem happens, is expected to stand up and speak to that issue. And if the leader doesn't speak, people get the impression that they like the confidence because they may have another agenda. But leaders take the proverbial bull by the horn and lead people out. That's why we appoint a leader.
297-5633 for General Russell Honoré. We're going to go to the phone lines in just a moment. You have a quote here from Calvin Coolidge, of course, was president in the time of the Mississippi River flood of 1927.
Yes, sir.
Persistence. Nothing in the world can take the place of persistence. Talent will not. Nothing is more common than unsuccessful men with talent. Genius will not. Unrewarded genius is almost a proverb. Education will not. The world is full of educated derelicts. Persistence and determination alone are omnipotent. The slogan, "Press on," has solved and always will solve the problems of the human race.
How true.
Well, Woody Allen once said 80% of success is showing up.
Well, I can remember having a conversation with Michael Brown, who was the FEMA guy on Wednesday when I arrived, and he said, "General, we've got a seat for you in my headquarters here in Baton Rouge." And I said, "I don't think so, because if I sit here, I'll be just like you. I need to go to New Orleans where the problem is."
What did you think of his performance or lack thereof?
I think he was overwhelmed. He was had done some successful mission from FEMA the year before, but he didn't deal with anything the size and scope of Katrina. And he was more worried about his reputation than he was about accomplishing the mission.
297-5633 is your number. Carl in North Baton Rouge. Carl, you're on the air with General Honoré. Hi, Carl.
Actually, Jim, this is Charles in North Baton Rouge, and good morning, Jim, and good morning, General. As a former Marine, we put a lot of emphasis on pre-positioning not only supplies but people, so I was shocked when there was no leaders in our state and federal government in New Orleans. And, General, how did you feel about the United States of America, much of the media, referring to the evacuees from Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans as refugees? Thank you.
Well, you bring a couple points that still rub people wrong today. As far as the pre-positioning, the National Guard was repositioned at Jackson Barracks. But again, Mother Nature overmatched the plan. And General Hunt Downer and a team of great soldiers were out there pre-positioned. But they became flooded. Nobody expected the levees to break. When the levee broke, it was a game changer.
John in Lafayette. Good morning, John. You're on WRKF with General Russell Honoré. Hi, John.
Yes, good morning. General, I just wanted to mention to you that I think it's great that you had retired here in Louisiana. I think you have the respect of 100% of the people of the state, which I think you're unique in that regard. My question really is, the last time you were on, you mentioned that you were going to have something for the legislature to consider. During the next session, you were talking about kicking their ant pile and doing something different in Louisiana. Do you still plan to do that?
Yes, and that ant pile we're going to kick is starting to bear some fruit in terms of, you know, today we started this show talking about social justice. Hopefully we ended talking about environmental justice, because the people of Louisiana deserve better than what we're getting in terms of how we are making sure that the companies that we revere, the companies that we work at, don't destroy our air, don't destroy our water, and don't poison our earth and destroy our wetlands. So I do think that ants pile is starting to be kicked. We had an article last night in the Baton Rouge paper, The Advocate, about a group of citizens up around Baker who are saying no to the state who have permitted a company that want to put toxic waste in their community. That is the ant pile we're talking about. We're talking about Bayou Corn, where, again, we've got a failure of the major proportion, and we don't have federal help in here helping us solve it. And we're talking about the wetlands, where the oil and gas company have left thousands of miles of canals that they did not close that has attributed to the loss of the wetlands.
877-217-5757, the line open for the first time in a while, and we'll go to some more of you as you talk with General Russell Honoré, Lieutenant General Honoré, the man who was at the helm when Louisiana was faltering mightily 8 years ago in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. And then 2010, 5 years later, we had the Deepwater Horizon tragedy. You write that the damage to the Gulf and its coast could have been lessened if BP would have more effectively aligned its strategy, tactics, and logistics for containing the massive amount of oil that escaped from its well. Regarding leadership or lack thereof, was in play when the BP disaster occurred?
First of all, when the incident happened, by their own reports, this was a high-risk operation. When I said the leaders got to be involved early in that book, the CEO of BP himself admitted that he did not know that event was happening. When you have a high-risk operation, people expect the leader to be there to make sure or to monitor that event to make sure that if something's wrong, they take responsibility. Plausible deniability is not an option for a leader to say they didn't know. If it's important, you have to have the right information systems, you must know. As far as BP not taking decisive action, they took decisive action responding in public relations and they have a public relations failure when the CEO says this thing has consumed his life and he want to get on with his life. At the same time, untold number of God's creatures were dying in the Gulf and our coastline was blackened with oil. This is a darn shame, and we should not accept that as Americans. And Louisianans being the sentinels or guards who watch the Mississippi River and the coast, we've got to speak up, because if not, we will be victims of this same industry that we revere.
Candy in Assumption Parish. Candy, good morning. You're on the air with General Honoré.
Good morning. I know personally General Honoré knows I have the utmost respect for him, but I would like the citizens of Louisiana to know what I think, and many people in the Bayou Corn area think of General Honoré. First, he stands up for social injustice and environmental injustice, and he is a fearless leader. I have seen him speak out on his beliefs, and he is not afraid to do or say the right thing and challenge both our state and local governments, as well as businesses that thrive in our area. And I would just like to say that we have the utmost respect for him and what he is doing for the African-American population, the Katrina evacuees, the Bayou Corn evacuees, and the people of Baker. And General, keep doing what you're doing, and thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Candy. I'm going down to Bayou Corn later today. We have a national news media event coming in. You know, last week, Jim, a lot of people, over 4 million people, watched that sinking that occurred down at Bayou Corn where the trees were sucked down by the into the salt dome. Many of the national reporters, some of them laughed, made joke of, hey, look at those trees. Isn't that something? But they kept talking about what? The story we hope to do this afternoon that will come out soon, we'll talk about why. Because real leaders have to focus on the why. The what may be obvious to many, but we've got to get after the why in Louisiana. Because, you know, the president is about to send troops to war over a chemical attack in Syria. Listen to me, Jim. About to send troops to war over a chemical attack. In a way, we have a silent chemical attack every day in Louisiana because we don't have safe air. It is a proven fact that between Louisiana and Baton Rouge and New Orleans, we live in Cancer Alley. We've got to have those businesses, but we've got to put procedures in place to make sure that they clean the air, that they have safe procedures. We want them to be successful. The nation cannot do without these businesses. We don't want them to go overseas, but they are going to have to practice safety. And they're going to have to put the right procedures in, and they're going to have to convince the people that they're doing the right thing.
297-5633 is your number. 877-217-5757. We'll return with General Russell Honoré and talk with him about everything happening from Denham Springs to Damascus. Back after this 90-second pause on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. J.C. Kane is producing, and our guest for our final segment is, once again, Lieutenant General Russell L. Honoré, U.S. Army retired, served in the military for 37 years, led the U.S. Department of Defense response to Katrina and Rita in 2005, was a commanding general in the Middle East and in Korea. Today, he is involved in various endeavors in business and in politics and in media. And you mentioned President Obama considering military action against Syria that is intended to deter and degrade that government's ability to launch chemical weapons. What do you think about the prospect of a military involvement in the Middle East by the United States once again?
Well, whether we act or in coordination with our partners, something has to be done, because what is happening in Syria, if it goes unchecked, will give other tyrants around the world that they have the right to do what they want, regardless of what the rest of the world think. And we do live in a global environment. People intentionally firing chemical weapons on civilians and their own citizens, that's not tolerable. We cannot, if we stand up and let this happen, we will lose an opportunity to again show the world that when things happen, the United States will be there, and we may be the first to act. Remember when we were going into World War II, when everybody was reluctant to do it, and we almost lost the entire Hawaii islands over waiting to see if a tyrant would change their ways. This tyrant need to go away. The unfortunate thing, what makes this so complex, if he leaves, what might come in behind him might be worse, Jim. And that is the Al-Qaeda influence inside Syria, what might happen. So there is no good answer, but having been to meetings at the Situation Room and the White House, having worked those target lists when we were working against Saddam Hussein, they have a very difficult problem, but we got the skill, we got to make sure we got the will, and the American people need to know that when we go to war, you don't kind of halfway go there. We can shoot missiles, but we need to be prepared to bring everything in the toolkit out. If this guy strike back, go after one of our ships, or if you go after our allies, we're going to have to go after him hard. Go big, go hard, get out.
But in your book, you discuss that military intervention as far as going to war with an enemy is always a last resort.
Absolutely. And I think this has been going on for over 2 years. It cost over 100,000 people in that country their lives. You know, there's got to be certain things we stand up for. And, you know, there may be a lot of conversation in history. We'll watch Iraq and Iran and Afghanistan in different ways. But if we're going to ever act and help people in need, it's going to have to be, because Iraq and Afghanistan, because what people had done to us. And a response, even questionable on the intelligence and why we did it and why we're still there in Afghanistan, that's the president has a plan to get out. But when it comes to Syria, we cannot sit around, the most gifted nation in the world, and watch people being slaughtered. It's just not in our DNA.
You have been in war. Were you ever scared?
I was very scared. I was in Desert Storm. I was a commander of 1,200 troops at the Port of Dammam. We had over 18 Scud missiles shot at my battalion.
How did you react?
Well, first of all, quickly, making sure we ducked and did the defensive measures we were told, but at the same time, controlling panic. I remember the first night the Scud missiles came in, all the troops wanted their weapons to go stand on the barrier line. What we had to explain to them, those missiles were coming from 700 miles away, and there was no way having ammunition in their M16 inside their tents, we're going to protect them. But that was a natural response.
Did you lose any of your troops?
We lost troops at the Port of Dammam to accidents. None to Scud missiles.
297-5633 HB in Denham Springs. HB, you're on the air with General Russell Honore. Hi, HB.
Good morning, General. Thank you for your service to our country and all over the world, really. My next question is this, revolves around some guests that Mr. Jim has had in the past about the industry using our freshwater supply aquifers here rather than drafting water from the Mississippi River. My question is this. This problem has been going on for quite some time, and we are under severe warning now from them using freshwater aquifers rather than the Mississippi. Why hasn't our state, local, and federal officials, past and present, done something to stop this and make them go to the Mississippi for their water supply to operate their plants? Thank you, sir.
Well, that's a good question, and that is why I spent all my spare time working on this issue to get environmental justice. There's no way we should be allowing plants to use water from the aquifers. The more we draw on those aquifers, the more the salt is going to get into them. The salt over in Plaquemine, Louisiana, the aquifer there has already been destroyed. The one at Lake Panure has been destroyed. The one that supports the Poyville is threatened. We've got to do something. Iberia Parish Sheriff has said he is concerned about the aquifer. That aquifer, the Chilcoot aquifer, serve about 10 parishes. And yet, the state has just issued another permit for another company to tap in that aquifer, using up to 5 million gallons of fresh water a day. I don't understand why. And that company that's doing it is a foreign company. So we do not benefit that much from these exports. I'll be honest with you. So we have to do something. If we don't do something, we're going to lose fresh water, and we're going to be drinking water out of the Mississippi River, while these chemical companies and these refineries will give their bosses big benefits and buy more corporate jets and buy villas around the world. And I'm just telling you, we've got to do something about it, and I'm glad you called in and brought that issue up, because it's environmental justice that we need here in Louisiana, and our state government need to protect us as opposed to being friends of the industry.
Mike Schaff, who says he's in Bayou Corn, says, I'd like to extend General Honoré gratitude for his service to our country, his service to our state during Katrina, and now for the work he's done here in Bayou Corn. It's with his foresight and presence that he has lifted the spirits of the residents. We are proud to have such an honorable man in our state. Our hope is that he decides to run for office so that he can be proud of our government once again. Now, last time you were on the show, somebody floated the idea of you running for governor, and I got several emails about it. Any thoughts about a political platform in the future?
No, I've said before, I won't run because there's no way in hell I could win. Number one, I would take on the companies to make sure they're environmentally safe. I would not give companies like one in the news today putting a $3 billion plant. I would not take $3 million of state money and give to a big company that's doing a $3 billion plant. That's like you got $1 million and I give you a penny. I wouldn't do that. I'd put that money in education. I'd put it in our K-12 school. I'm not a big supporter of TOPS. I think people ought to work their own way through school. The idea that we're going to take state money and give kids so they can go to school free and drive their new BMWs and live in apartments downtown is crazy. We are too poor a state. We cannot afford that. We cannot afford that kind of a program. And I'd make sure that our public schools were strong, because our public schools is our answer. It is not this direction we're going in. So my platform already probably wouldn't win. So there's no need for me. I might as well be an advocate and get out here and talk and try to get people who and support people that might be able to do that. But no, I would not win, so I'm not going to run.
But you,
and we've got to pay more tax in Louisiana.
You're sincere, though. And most politicians, whether they're sincere or not, they're not regarded as being sincere. I think that that your integrity and your sincerity would go a long way, whether people agreed with you or not.
Well, and again, the other part of the platform is I'd reduce over half of the parishes, get rid of about a third of them.
That might be a problem.
Well, we don't need it. That's why I won't win. We don't need all the parishes we have. We got too much government. And that's a way to reduce it. You would go from three sheriffs to one. You'd go to one county administrator. You'd have one school system. And I would put the school systems back under the control of the senior elected official in the state, as opposed to every school board out there creating Supreme Court decisions.
297-5633, Gaston on Brightside. Hi, Gaston. You're on the air with General Honoré.
Good morning, General. I was curious. Why is it that we don't have the United States Army protecting our border on the Mexican side? Why do we have to have three and four different agencies like the TSA and the Border Patrol and the Customs and everything? Why don't we have the Army keeping it from being invaded?
Well, you asked a good question, and I will give my best. I used to run that program when I was in the Pentagon on the Joint Chiefs of Staff for the chairman. The border is a unique situation in that the work on the border is law enforcement. Law enforcement, by our Constitution, is handled, number one, by the local in the counties and parishes around the country, as they are along the border. The federal government is in charge of the border because the border, dealing with a foreign nation, let's talk Mexico, that is the provision of the federal government on controlling that border and dealing with controlling that border. It is up to the federal government to create the civilian-type law enforcement, like Border Patrol and other agencies to protect that border. We used to provide federal surveillance assets along that border. Then we ended up with a couple incidents that became major incidents because troop inadvertently shot a young kid on the border, and it created a major problem, which pulled federal troops from being involved in border surveillance. But with the right political will, we could put what we need to on the border. I'm not sure if federal troops are the solution. For a long time, we had 1,000 National Guard troops down there who were doing a great job, who were supplementing the Border Patrol. But we could put anything we want there. It's up to the leadership in the United States to have the will to want to do that, and then to figure out how much resources you want to spend on what you might think protecting that border. Because when you protect again Mexico, the other door in Canada is always open. You got people come across that border, and it is a lot bigger than Mexico. We can't put half of our army on the Mexican and the Canadian border. We've got to figure out how we're going to do this.
In your book, you discuss the Honoré Center for Undergraduate Student Achievement. How is this working?
It's working well. We had last year, we started off with 16 young men at Southern University in New Orleans. We have 11 of those are still in the program. We're very proud. They are very accomplished in their first year of study. We just started off last week at Southern New Orleans with another 18 young men. This program is being supported by a legislator, and these young men go in and they get their student loans. The promise we've made to them is that when they graduate, if they go teach 2 years in school, their loan will be forgiven. The other thing we do, Jim, is that we give them a computer. We put them in a room. One of the young men we picked, these young men are challenged in terms of economically as well as to have community and family support to get them in college. None of these young men could pass the SAT at the right level to get in public college. Some of them had grade problems, and they were like lumps of coal that can be turned into diamonds if we put them in the right environment. They are doing great. We make sure that they have study hall. They get to go to the gym several times a week, and we give them a few bucks every month to make sure that they can focus on their school, and they have to do volunteer work in the community. They have to give back. And the citizens of New Orleans and around the state have coming forward, and they're supporting us with the additional funds we need to take care of these young men. One of the young men told us, Jim, that when he reported to Southern University in New Orleans and went into his dorm room, it was the first time he ever had a bid by himself in his life. And he was 19 years old.
You write in Leadership in the New Normal that 2 days before Katrina hit, the New Orleans Saints had a football game. The day before Hurricane Gustav hit, LSU had a football game. Neither game was called off. And then you write, talk about false economy.
Right. Things were not done in terms of the evacuation because these football games are economic events. Mm-hmm. And many times the economy, and just like we saw with Hurricane Sandy with the mayor of New York, wanted to have the New York Marathon 2 days after the storm. It's because of economic issues. We've got to be aware of that as citizens, and we've got to release that pressure from our politicians to make sure that they do the right thing to protect the people, that it's not always about the economy, and it's all always about the companies who are here and being in fear that they're going to leave. There are major companies I don't think going to pick up and go to Mississippi. Okay? They're not going to do it. So we've got to hold them to a standard. And as a way of the evacuation, the other thing you find in New Orleans is we've divided our government up. Before Katrina came that day, the mayor was calling for a voluntary evacuation on Friday. That's the night the Saints had their game. And I love the Saints, like most people in Louisiana. The school board in New Orleans decided they were going to have school. So how in the heck can we run a government in a parish with the senior elected official in the parish saying one thing and the school board saying something else because there's a Saints game tonight? I mean, that's stupid.
How did that experience affect you?
Well, it gave me a passion to, once I got out of the Army, that we did not have to accept the things that are not going well as they were. There are a lot of things that go great in our state. We have a great culture. We have great families. We have a great place to live. But if we don't focus on those things that's influencing our quality of life and our well-being, and what is that? Good health care, good schools for our kids, clean air, clean water. If we don't take care of that, we're not going to have crawfish to eat in Louisiana. We will not have saccades to go fish, and we will not have blue crab off the coast of Mississippi, the coast of the wetlands, because we'll have destroyed it with these chemicals.
Well, thank you, General Russell Luke Honore, for your service to our country and continuing service to our state. Thank you, General.
Thank you.
We'll be back tomorrow. Until then, stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.